The Daily Connect Podcast, the voice of the RNIB Connect community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Connect Podcast for Wednesday, the 8th of August 2018. And coming up today, we are going to be talking about sport. Yes, not content with coaching blind players in Northern Ireland, we hear from Simon McFarland, who's been travelling to India to start blind tennis there. Also coming up, we hear an amazing story from Japan, and we hear the story of Takashi, who was always interested in the sounds of things, whether it was banging a dustbin lid or listening to a melody. Well, his family never dreamt that his interests would take him to not just London, the Paralympics, but even Glastonbury as well. And if you're into colouring books, or think you might be, then I have got the story just for you. If you're blind or partially sighted, you can join in the fun as well. That's all coming up.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
But we start the show with Pause for Thought this week. And you might remember on Monday's podcast, we met Lynn Holdsworth, and she told us all about the challenges of self-training her dog Lucy after the sudden death of her previous guide dog. Well, Lucy is now coming up for retirement, and Lynn has a decision to make. Sit on the waiting list for guide dogs again, or venture out and train a new dog. She's been talking to our own Laura Kirker.
Last time we spoke to Lynn Holdsworth, she was telling us all about Lucy, her self-trained guide dog, and the adventures that they encountered together. I'm talking to Lynn again. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Laura.
And now, unfortunately, our lovely Lucy is coming to the end of her working life. Is that right?
Yeah, she's about 8 years old now, and she's starting to say, oh, can't be bothered today, leave me in bed a bit longer.
And what does that mean for you now? I mean, have you approached guide dogs?
I have. I've been on the list. Well, it took me 4 months to get on the list, and I've actually been on it since last October.
Oh, so wow. We'll
be calling up for a year now.
So you're facing a similar situation to last time where they they can't get you a dog well?
Yeah. Look, in every guide dog owner's ideal world, you'd put down one harness and pick up another one.
Mm.
Well, I would say most owners would want it to happen that way, but there just isn't the supply to meet the demand.
And what does that leave you with? Are you? I understand that you've met a new dog, who might be your new.
I have. So I'm working in. Sorry, I'm living in Lancashire, working across the Pennines in Yorkshire, and my journey by train would be quite horrendous without a dog. I've got a driver doing it at the minute, but I don't want. I'm really only doing that because Lucy's not up for it anymore. So I've met this German Shepherd who is beautiful in every way, except that he's got some dog and cat distraction going on, and I'm seriously considering training him as my next guide dog.
So how did you hear about it?
He lives across the road from my stepson, so we were picking him up and my other half spotted him out at the garden gate, and we went to stroke him, just saying that he's a nice dog, and the guy said, do you want him?
Really?
Yeah.
You never really take those kind of things seriously, though.
No, but my other half did. He went back the next day and said, are you serious? And he's like, well, semi, just see how it goes.
Wow. And how do you feel about taking on this training once again?
Oh, my goodness. It is quite a big, it's a big ask. It's a huge challenge, especially because I've got, you know, I'm working full time. I've got a long journey to and from work. So I'd have to then find time to do the training every day. But in desperation, I'll do it.
Is it the desperation that's driving you to do it, or is there any
Absolutely.
Part of you that wants to do it?
No, there was the first time. I was curious about whether it could be done by a blind person because people kept telling me it couldn't.
Mm.
And there was an aspect of me that wanted to prove them wrong. But now I know that, no, I don't really want to be doing it again.
And how do you feel about, well, not obviously to everybody, but German Shepherds and Labradors are very different when it comes to training, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. I've seen that even just taking him out for a walk. German Shepherds are a lot more, I think they're a lot more inquisitive. They're a lot more fussy about their eating habits and a change of routine and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it would be very different.
And do you know how you would approach it? Do you know what kind of methods you might use as opposed to...
Yeah, the play it by ear and fly by the seat of your pants method. I really would just try things, and if they work, I'll just keep doing them. We've already started clicker training him just to see how he responds, and he's responding quite well to that.
But obviously, you said that you don't really want to be doing your own training again. And do you anticipate facing the same kind of problems that you had with Lucy if you train this dog in terms of like accreditation and what that means?
Well, at this moment in time, I still wouldn't be able to get the dog accredited, but I think the landscape is starting to change because the government is talking to Assistance Dogs UK, to owner trainer representatives and to other interested parties about setting a standard by which owner trained assistance dogs of all types, not just guide dogs, but hearing dogs, epilepsy dogs, emotional support dogs, all sorts of owner trained assistance dogs will be able to be accredited. So that's potentially great news.
And what would that mean as opposed to, because Lucy, she was pretty much fine everywhere, wasn't she? People accepted her as your guide dog. It was the only thing was when you were travelling abroad that you had trouble.
There's really only one airline that I can use. And I think that's because they haven't asked me outright if she is a Guide Dogs UK trained dog. And I, you know, because if they did that, I would just have to be honest and say no. And so I can't use EasyJet, and there's other various airlines that I can't use with her. EasyJet have been very upfront that they don't want my owner trained assistance dog on their flight.
Have they point blank refused?
I had a conversation with David Luckett, who's the head of accessibility for EasyJet, and he said absolutely not, and he wasn't planning for that to change anytime soon.
Because he has a guide dog, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
Because you've had the problems with accreditation, and you've had the problems, but equally you've had problems waiting for dogs with Guide Dogs UK. And I mean, although the government has started saying that owner-trained guide dogs potentially should be accredited by one of the organisations that can accredit them. Should you, is training your own guide dog, is that something that people should be doing if they can?
If I hadn't had the excellent training that I've had from Guide Dogs UK, I would not be confident to train my own dog. So I would really recommend that anybody who hasn't had a guide dog before probably don't do it. If you've had a guide dog or two dogs, whatever, and you're feeling confident that you can do it, it's not an easy task. It's expensive. It's time consuming. And it can be frustrating, heartbreaking sometimes. So it's not for the faint hearted. But if you have the time, money, and you feel as though you've got the expertise, you can always give it a go.
Because they're having such trouble, if people are confident enough, do you think that guide dogs could provide support to people who might want to train their own dogs and almost kind of help them out a little bit?
Look, I think if they can't meet the demand, that's an avenue they should be seriously looking at. I would have really benefited from their support, and I did actually get a little bit of support from them, but I think it's probably under the radar, but I really benefited from it, and I could have done with some more of it. There's a lot of things that you have to think about before you go into training a dog that guide dogs really could give us some more hands-on support.
And what will happen to our lovely Lucy when you move on?
I promised her, you know, when I took her out of rescue, I promised her she wasn't going anywhere else. And so she's not going anywhere else. She's going to stay with me wherever I am. She's going to get to swim most days and run in the park and chill out with her paws up on the sofa.
Thank you so much for speaking to us today, Lynn. Good luck with... well, potentially Zane. And
thank you.
And I really hope that Lucy enjoys her retirement.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Lynn.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Now, not content with coaching blind players in Northern Ireland, Simon McFarland has been travelling to India to start blind tennis there. Here he is telling Sheila Armstrong from Torch Trust on today's show about this fantastic initiative.
The World Championships involve lots of different countries, but you've been involved in India. You've been blogging about a project for blind children playing tennis in India. Could you tell us a bit about that, please, Simon?
Oh, yeah, I was approached at the start of the year there to go over to Delhi in India. And first of all, to train coaches in blind tennis. So India has approximately 22 million blind people, which is a crazy statistic. You know, there's only, I always relate to Northern Ireland here, where there's 1.8 million population. So if you say that's nearly 20 times of Northern Ireland are all blind, then it's quite an alarming statistic. And part of the problem over there is they have no help. So they have no canes, they have no guide dogs. After I trained the coaches, because the coaches had never been trained in the blind tennis, we then bought the players the next day, and the players are arriving in sixes and sevens, like a bit like a conga line is the way I like to say it. And if the first person hit something, they told the other six what they hit. That was their cane or their guide dog, which is which is scary, but they found a way to kind of be quite independent when they were running on the tennis court. And you know, most of these guys were B1 level, which is mean completely no sight. And when they were running on a tennis court, then they were quite independent for themselves because they weren't too scared to run. They've had all their scary times and they're not afraid to hit anything in front of them.
Yeah, so you managed to get something underway over there, didn't you?
Yeah, the best thing from over there was going to some of the blind schools as well. So there was two blind schools we visited, which are completely made up of under 11-year-old, you know, kids. And it was great. They're playing some sort of games in the playgrounds by themselves, but mostly blind cricket. Blind cricket in India is a massive sport. They won the blind world championships for cricket. What my aim is for, obviously, if there's 22 million blind people in India, there's no reason why they couldn't try to dominate the sport of blind tennis as well. They have a bigger pool of players. That's what I'm trying to do in Ireland now as well. We only have about, I'd say, 40 players in the whole of Ireland playing blind tennis. England and the UK, you know, mostly England, because there's only one club in Scotland playing at the minute, but England would have about 250 to 300 players now. Therefore, they've got a bigger pool. They've got a good tournament structure. They've got a tournament nearly every month, and that's why the GB team is the best in the world at the minute at the blind tennis as well.
That's great. And you've said in your blog that people can help. How can they do that?
There's different ways to help. If you already know or live in India, obviously, you can donate to your local blind schools. Or if you go on my blog and even have a read of it, because it's very interesting to read. It's,
it certainly is. I'd agree with that.
It's shmcfa86.simplesite.com. And that's the site where you can read about my blog. And then at the end, it tells you how you can maybe help if you want to donate some money or resources. Even they're looking, you know, blind tennis balls, for example, or tennis rackets. It costs about £240 to put one child through a year of primary school in India for the blind. And that includes they stay overnight, accommodation, food, medical expenses, and everything. So it's not really that large of an amount when you think about it in terms of UK money. But for £240, you can basically look after one child. They leave their home in the middle of India and they usually never really see their parents again, or sometimes depends if they want to make it in life, so to speak, they would leave their family behind and try to get a job afterwards. Yeah,
so that would include the tennis practice as well as the schooling and the medical expenses and everything, does it?
Yeah, we're trying to get the tennis from the coaches that we trained into the adults as well. So we trained 17 adults players as well as 17 coaches. And the hope then is the 17 coaches take it in to the schools that we went to, as well as still train the adults. So the adults could have a team short term, and then the kids would be playing it just for their own good. And then maybe in a few years, they could become the adults playing it as well.
Well, that's great. That sounds great. Have you had any updates since you've been over there?
They're quite slow in developing stuff in India. So there's more people playing now and more areas. So they've started a group in Mumbai, which is in the south of India as well, which is great. So actually, I say they're quite slow, but they've got about 45 players playing in total, which in relation to Ireland is big, but in relation to their 22 million people, it's not that much. So they could definitely expand further, but they just need to set up their own structure. So they're trying to join the International Association at the minute, and then they can do things properly from there.
Well, that sounds really great, really promising. And of course, we wish them all the best as well. And thank you very much for coming on, especially after your hard work and your practice. Thanks very much, Simon.
No problem. The Daily Connect
podcast. Now, everybody seems to be using colouring books these days, and it's not just the kids. In fact, the adult colouring book market is very lucrative at the moment. But there's no reason for us as blind or partially sighted people to miss out, as Roland Myers reported for us on today's Daily Connect.
RNIB has a small selection of tactile paint by numbers and tactile colouring books. The idea behind these is that because they have both tactile and print images, blind and partially sighted parents can, for example, enjoy the books with sighted or vision impaired children. The Paint by Numbers pack includes 10 animal images, each of which is printed and embossed on heavy paper, with titles and numbers written in large print and braille. Fact sheets are supplied in print and contracted braille, and a number colour code is also provided. A variety of line widths and styles is used to help guide the painting or crayoning by numbers. Separately, RNIB also sells a colouring tactile pad and two colouring books. And Claire Grant from RNIB described these books for us. And we first asked Claire what age range they're mainly aimed at.
All ages, really. So the colour and paint books and the sort of colouring pad, they're focused more on kind of like 3 years and up, which is quite nice. The colouring pad, they suggest 5 years and up. The paint by number, they actually suggest 6+. What I love about the Paint by Number, though, is that it's definitely a family book, I think, because of what it offers. It has these fun facts in the front as well about all the different animals that you're going to be colouring later on, which kind of makes it more of a family, get involved, everybody's learning something. I didn't know what one of the animals was myself, so that was quite exciting. And nice, simple images. But I would say in the Paint by Numbers, they seem a bit more exciting images, I think.
Well, I was going to ask about the business of family involvement. Presumably, a vision-impaired parent, therefore, could make use of these books if they have a sighted child, or indeed if the child has vision impairment as well. Everyone can join in?
Yeah, absolutely, particularly on the Paint by Numbers book, because these fun facts, they're in print and they're in Braille. And then with the nice big images that you've got, they've also got the print and they've got the Braille as well. So nice, big, thick, bold lines. So even if you're partially sighted, there's such nice, thick, bold lines. And obviously they're raised as well. So if you are blind, you can make the most of that as well. But I think absolutely you could have a blind parent with a sighted child or vice versa.
And what's the layout then? You said that they are tactile, they're Braille. Obviously, for a sighted person, you see an image. So what's the actual kind of relationship between those different ways of accessing the image?
In the Paint by Numbers pack, you have in the back of the package 10 nice big square images. Now, the images come with thick black lines, and there are also different levels of lines, which we can come back to. But they also have large print numbers and titles. And then they've got the Braille numbers and titles next to the relevant bits of large print.
So you can read them if you're sighted, but you can also see the outline with the lines, and there's Braille information as well.
Yeah, there's a colour code that comes with the Paint by Numbers, obviously being Paint by Numbers. And so where you've got, for example, in a section, the number 2 written in large print, you've also got the number 2 in Braille. So you can easily go around the page and determine which bit should be what colour, whether you're blind or sighted.
And the description you talked about, that's separate from the pictures themselves. It explains kind of what's in the book.
So, yeah, so we've got these pictures at the back. And then in the front of the pack, we've got in large print and in Braille, the sort of kind of introduction to the pack about what it's for. So teaching colour concepts with an emphasis on real world colours, encouraging visual and tactile exploration. And then it goes into specific fun facts about each animal. So in that, it will talk about maybe what the size is, what the weight is. For example, a capybara apparently can weigh in excess of 100 pounds. So that's 45 kilos. Who knew? And at the bottom of the page, it's got a colour code. So that will be what you then pick up when you find your picture in the back of the capybara. You would then use that colour code to colour in the drawing.
And most importantly, the painting, you know, the title is Tactile Paint by Numbers. How do you actually colour it, paint it? What's the physical sort of action that you do to complete the picture?
So you can either use paints, but you can just use markers or crayons or pencils, whatever you fancy. But the idea is that because you've got these nice raised tactile lines, you can follow the lines with your fingers, or you can obviously visual if you've got some sight. But you go around following the lines with your fingers around the outlines. And we do have different levels of line. So, for example, you've got the nice, thick, solid lines, which are the outline. So thinking about a butterfly, for example, they often have sections of colour inside the wings. Each section of colour inside the wing is a slightly narrower tactile line, still quite a nice thickness, so they're easy to follow. But they're slightly narrower, so you know to change the colour. And then for background bits, so there's a flower on the butterfly image, that's got dashed lines around it. So you know that's more of a background colour. So you kind of go around the image, use your fingers, or if you've got some sight, you can obviously do it by sight as well. Just go around the image and fill it in.
And this Tactile Paint by Numbers book, that's fairly new. You've had for a little while the Sensation Colour and Paint books. You've got a couple of those, I think, and also a colouring pad. Do they work along similar lines, identical lines?
They're kind of similar. They're less complex. So I would definitely describe the colour and paint books. So these are the colour sensation books. You get books one and two, and then there's a separate one, which is the colouring pad, as you said. These are literally just the images. So they do have a title that is, again, in large print and braille. And for the colour and paint book ones and book two, they have a nice spiral bound down the side, like the paint by numbers. So they're nice and easy to turn the pages. And you just work your way through the book. And there's a even nice little pull-out plastic protector, which you can pull out of the book and put behind the drawing that you want to paint or colour, however you want to do it, just to protect the next image as well. In the colouring pad, they're all loose leaf, so you can literally just pull them straight out and you can just colour them wherever you want to go.
And what kind of images have you got in the Colour Sensation colouring pad that you've just described, and also the two paint books?
So in the pad, we've got a bear with a balloon, got some birds, a butterfly, a flower, kind of sort of more nature things, and there's also a train. And then in the Colour Sensation books, they've got multiple images but under different themes. So in the book one, there's a jungle theme, so that's got like a giraffe and a peacock. Food theme, pets theme, and a mythological theme. So all those who love a nice mermaid, there's a mermaid in there. And in book two, we've also got like a sea life theme, which are your crabs, octopus, turtles. We've got transport, garden, and then more of a celestial theme. So the nighttime moon, stars, and the sun.
And the Paint by Numbers Tropical Rainforest book pack costs £32.99. The Colour Sensation Tactile Pad is priced at £5.50, and the two Sensation Tactile Colouring Books, 1 and 2, each costs £5.99. These prices exclude VAT, which is not paid on any of these items if bought by a blind or partially sighted person or by someone on their behalf. And if you'd like more information about any of these books, you can phone RNIB's National Helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999, or you can, if you prefer, email them at helpline@rnib.org.uk.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Finally on the podcast today, when he was growing up in Japan, Takashi was always interested in the sounds of things, whether it was a banging of a dustbin lid or listening to a melody. Well, his family never dreamed that this interest would take him to London, the Paralympics, and Glastonbury. Takashi tells us now how something that was supposed to be a comfort in his blindness became his career and a big adventure.
Konnichiwa, Kikuchi Takashi desu. Tokyo kara kimashita. That means, hello, my name is Takashi Kikuchi. I'm from Tokyo. Tokyo is a very, very crowded city. Many thousands of people are in one small place. A lot of traffic, very busy road, even on the pavement. And fortunately, the people are kind, but otherwise it is very difficult for the people with any form of disability to negotiate with. In Japan, like many people say, we had a tradition to be negative about the disability. They rather use the word handicap, and that word was quite common. I was not familiar with the word disability until I actually came here, and I think this also explains the attitude. And the disabled people themselves also tended to be quite negative about their own conditions. But now the things are changing, and the culture of exchanging is happening more often and more widely. We are developing more open attitude, so it is now different from it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. When I was born almost 50 years ago, my family, first of all, didn't know what to do. And only the advice they first of all received was that my problem with the optic nerves wouldn't be cured. So I was sent to the National Blind School. And at the same time, I also had some occasions to visit the state school where the normal people usually go. So I had time to match up with some other pupils around the same age. And I got the confidence because I made sure that I was studying the same thing in the same level. I was first of all given the opportunity to experience some music when I was very small. And I first of all learned the piano and then violin. And my parents hoped I would have something I could enjoy in my life because there's no hope for curing my disability. And they thought I could have something to enjoy for all my life. So there's nothing to do with the ambition to become a professional musician or anything like that. I was particularly interested in the things making some sound. So some music instruments and other things like typewriters or even the old LP record players, everything became my toys. And I really enjoyed playing around with the machine. And sometimes it annoyed some people because once I touched it, I wanted to play with them. I enjoyed music making a lot. And gradually I became interested in studying it more properly. And gradually I became musical. I studied little by little. I didn't like practicing, but I liked playing with the instruments, which also annoyed the teacher, because in some ways I really liked the improvisation and I didn't like to play anything I was told to. When I was about 16, I met the viola and I liked the sound very much, and I liked that depth and a sort of mellow color of the sound, and I was really charmed by that tonality of the instrument, and I thought this is the one instrument I could study professionally. I had a position in the National Top University for the Performance Arts, and I was already doing my doctoral studies there, and as a part of it I came to the Royal Academy of Music. So that was my first motivation to come to England. The people ask me whether it was difficult to come here permanently, but for me it was difficult not to think about staying here permanently at some point, because everything was much more interesting than I thought. I really insisted I would do this, and I was very glad I was successful. With the British Bar Orchestra, we played in the closing ceremony at the London Paralympics. That was the first big event. I had an opportunity to play in Glastonbury with the same group. Well, there's a project called the Army of Generals, directed by Charles Hazlewood, and some members of the British Bar Orchestra are now sent to join them. So I was in Glastonbury and it was so exciting. Some people told me that we at least had 6,000-7,000 people listening there, and more than 200,000 people were watching and listening to us at home through the TV. And it was such an exciting moment. Very, very challenging for me to learn huge symphony. I was so glad I shared such an exciting moment with the colleagues, as well as many, many thousands of people watching and listening to us.
Thanks to Takashi for telling us his story. And that ends our Daily Connect for Wednesday. Back tomorrow, as always, on air, 10 till 12, and right here on the podcast just after 5 on the RNIB Connect feed. Thanks for listening. Catch you tomorrow.
The Daily Connect podcast.